This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. On the same day that President Obama announced that he's had a change of heart and now publicly supports same-sex marriage, there were quieter moves on Capitol Hill to protect the rights of some who do not. On Wednesday, the House Armed Services Committee passed its version of a bill designed in part to protect military chaplains from coming under pressure to marry service members of the same sex. This latest move, which could face strong opposition in the Senate, comes as a response to concerns expressed by chaplains that their own beliefs are being compromised. Joining me in the studio to discuss the issue further is retired Army Chaplain Douglas E. Lee. He belongs to the Presbyterian Church in America and is a spokesperson for the Chaplain Alliance for Religious Liberty. Mr. Lee, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here. Thank you for asking.
So first, we should start off by saying that it's really the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell last year that's brought this issue to the fore. That was the policy banning gays from serving openly in the military. Now they can serve openly. What has been the impact on chaplains? What has that meant for the chaplaincy?
Here's the way I describe it. Chaplains can continue to serve their faith group with freedom and boldness and under the First Amendment, which is good. But there are things bubbling behind the scenes and at lower levels that often are not noticed by the community and by America and by leaders in the military.
Because when the debate was happening, it was really the chaplains that raised a lot of concerns about what repeal would mean for them.
Absolutely.
Can you reiterate, what were those concerns?
Well, you might know or recall, not just chaplains, but other organizations across the country began to equate the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell with consequential religious liberty issues along the way. That were this particular behavior to be recognized in the military that way, that there would eventually be challenges to what chaplains could or could not say in their ministry.
In frank terms, we're talking about chaplains being put in a position where they would feel that they couldn't express their concern.
Correct.
That homosexuality is a sin.
Correct. And you have to understand that the majority of the denominations and faith groups that are in the military, you know, from Orthodox Jews, Muslims, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, majority of Protestants, Roman Catholic Church, I mean, they're all from traditions that hold that homosexuality is a sin. And so the question is then, well, will chaplains continue to be able to speak that way?
So we heard the president come out last week and express his personal opinion about same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. But this is far from policy. The Pentagon has come out and said that when it comes to chaplains, they're not required to marry same-sex couples.
That is true.
So what are the concerns among
the chaplains? Well, the concern of some of the congressmen, there are quite a few senators and congressmen that are thinking about this, and that's part of the reason some of these bills have come before the committees this last week and so on. And so Congress is the only group that can help make sure that liberty remains out there. The military just responds to the civilian authorities. And so they salute, they say, someone tells them what the policy is from on high, and they salute and say, we'll implement it. And that's what's happened here.
Doug Lee is a retired Army chaplain and member of the Chaplain Alliance for Religious Liberty. He joined us in our studio in Washington. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gideon Lewis Krause was confused. A few years ago, the American 20-something was living in Berlin, hanging out in art galleries and nameless speakeasies, preoccupied with living a creatively meaningful life, but kind of unsure about what that meant or how to make it happen. So when a friend asked him to join him on a pilgrimage in Spain, he went, hoping to find some answers. After Spain, Lewis Krause went on to complete two other famous pilgrimages, one in Japan and one in the Ukraine. The result of that experience is a new memoir called A Sense of Direction. Gideon Lewis Krause joins us now from our New York studios. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
So tell me a little bit about the first trip you go on is with a friend of yours, Tom,
right.
Also a writer. And the trip, this is a famous pilgrimage. This is a religious pilgrimage, right?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. It was a fairly serious religious pilgrimage for 1,000 years. And then in the last 30 years, it's become strangely ahistorically popular with a young, mostly secular crowd. So we met almost nobody who was doing it for explicitly religious reasons. These days, what most people do is they start at the French-Spanish border on the French side of the Pyrenees, and they walk to Santiago de Compostela. It's about 550 miles. Takes most people about a month.
Thousands of people do this particular walk in Spain every year. And you describe in the book this greeting that people
give. Buen Camino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That pilgrims give one another on
very,
the trail.
Very, very useful, because it can mean a whole variety of things. Hello, it very frequently means goodbye, as in, like, it was nice to meet you, walk on. You know, you would meet someone and like them, and then you would spend a week walking with them, and then all of a sudden, buen camino. It was simultaneously the, like, have a good, spiritually satisfying, meaningful journey, and also, like, buzz off. I'm tired of seeing you.
I noticed, though, there's also a lot of judging on the trail. I mean, you kind of think of the pilgrimage and pilgrims as being these very humble, kind of enlightened souls. But it gets kind of catty. You start judging people, differentiating people who do the entire trail and those who kind of cut in.
Yeah. Anybody who started even 10 feet after you was an inauthentic pilgrim, was not doing the whole thing. And it's just a way of differentiating yourself as you go along and dealing with the anxiety you have about doing this absurd thing.
You come out of your experience in Spain and you don't stop there. You decide you want to take another journey, this time in Japan.
Well, so while I was on the Camino in Spain, I met these two Japanese people. And two of them got very excited and said, we have this thing, the Shikoku Ohenro. It's sort of like the Japanese Camino. And I looked it up, and it's this circuit of 88 Buddhist temples that ring the smallest of the four Japanese islands. And it's very similar to the Camino. It also was wildly popular during the Middle Ages, because in Japan it was literally the only reason, under the feudal shoguns, the only reason you could leave home was if you were on a religious pilgrimage. It's a little less than 900 miles. It takes most people about 6 weeks, and maybe 10 to 12 foreigners do it a year. So I met two other foreigners while I was there.
So this is a fundamental difference from the experience that you just had in Spain. In experience, there were all these people and pilgrims, and it was this communal experience.
Yes.
In Japan, you're alone, basically.
I was very, very alone. I met almost nobody. I went weeks without talking to anyone. It's almost all on asphalt, as opposed to the Camino, which is all on these nice paths. And it was raining the whole time.
But this is hard. This is kind of what you think of as, like, the pilgrimage.
Exactly.
And you're alone. And,
exactly.
I mean, in some ways, was that a more authentic experience?
Well, I mean, one of the questions that I talk about in the book is, what does this authenticity even mean? Because there are a lot of people who say, well, this isn't authentic anymore. It used to be this religious thing, and now it's just this kind of backpacker jaunt. And ultimately, these are all distinctions I reject. I say, you know, the fact that your feet are coming apart and the fact that you've been walking for 8 hours in the rain, I mean, like, authenticity is the last thing that you care about.
Gideon, you are using these walks to try to do some thinking about the relationship you've had with your dad.
Right.
Which becomes a central theme in the book. And for your final pilgrimage, you set out to go to Ukraine. It's not so much a long walk as this kind of massive gathering to pay homage to a Jewish mystic. And you invite your brother and your dad to join you on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the book had, as I had gone on, the book had really become about this idea of pilgrimage as pretext, that it was always a pretext to leave home. It was a pretext to take some time to think about your life. It was a pretext to think about forgiveness and all these things. And then I thought, okay, well, if this is about the kind of pretext you need to make to try to change your life, I'm going to use this Jewish pilgrimage as a pretext to have all of the conversations with my dad about his life and his sexuality.
We should say he was
he came out late
in life.
Yeah, so my dad came out when I was 19. So I thought, like, okay, we're going to use this ridiculous Jewish pilgrimage that I basically have no interest in, full of, like, all these Hasids that I definitely do not identify with, to have these conversations with my dad.
You guys just couldn't go to a deli on the Upper West Side and call
it a
day?
Well, no. See, that's the thing about pilgrimage, is that if you go to a deli, then you're just, it's like another day that you're at a deli. Whereas, like, if you fly to the Ukraine, the whole idea of pilgrimage is that you're hoping that you're going to rise to the occasion in some way, right? So you hope that there is going to be something structural about the idea of making a miserable trip. I mean, we had this terrible trip on Aeroflot, and we finally got there, and then we had to drive through Ukraine in the night, fearing about getting shaken down by cops. So all of these, you know, minor but real austerities then, I think, primed us to be like, we're in a special place doing a special thing. We're going to rise to the occasion of having really serious and candid talks here that we would not have in a deli on the Upper West Side.
Did it work? Did you get what you wanted?
It did. I mean, it absolutely exceeded all of my expectations, really. It was amazing. By the end of it, we kind of had to flee in haste from these Hasids because we had just had too much. So we like ran out with our suitcases and our unkosher meat and got into the rental car and shook off the Ukrainian cops and like got onto the highway and just like we're on our way to Odessa and just breathed a sigh of relief. And then we had just had this great vacation and it felt completely different. It felt like something really new. It felt like a way that the three of us hadn't been together in a really long time.
Author Gideon Lewis Krause, his new memoir is called A Sense of Direction. He spoke with us from our New York studios. Gideon, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rachel. This has been great.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Some welcome news for drivers across the country. Gas prices are falling. The average price for a gallon of regular gas nationwide is now $3.73. That's according to AAA. It's a drop of nearly 20 cents in 1 month. As NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, industry analysts expect gas prices to keep falling.
You can get in a lot of trouble trying to predict commodity prices. Phil Flynn is a market analyst at PFG Best Trading in Chicago. He says there is one thing you can predict.
You know, I always kind of kid around that the first sign of spring in this country is when politicians start complaining about high gasoline prices.
It's as simple as this. The emperor has no clothes.
House Speaker John Boehner in the early spring.
And they can't talk about the record on gas prices because gas prices have more than doubled on the president's watch.
Not to be outdone, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi also in spring.
Immediately, we have to stop the Wall Street speculation, which is cornering the market on oil and adding, experts say, almost 20%, 17, 18, 20% to the price at the pump.
Phil Flynn, the analyst, says it wasn't speculating or a lack of supply that drove up prices in the first place. He says it was a fear of military action against Iran and the Iranian embargo, as well as countries around the globe hoarding oil.
But now, because of a reduced risk of a conflict with Iran and the fact that OPEC has really replaced Iranian oil barrel for barrel, and countries across the globe have beefed up their supplies, we're now seeing the price of oil fall pretty dramatically, and that's dragging gasoline prices in many parts of the country down with it.
While gas prices have fallen from their high of $3.93, they haven't fallen that much. We're only down to $3.73. Analysts say the price is still well within the range that causes people to change their habits, like Jim Caesar of Athens, Ohio.
Actually, I drive to Coolville right now to get gas when I go camping on the weekends because it's a lot cheaper there.
Now, that's about a half-hour drive, nearly two dozen miles to get cheaper gas. But Caesar says every little bit counts.
When the price goes up, I drive less, obviously, because the fuel costs more. Fuel reflects on everything, your groceries, your utilities, anything you do that's related to oil is a factor in that.
Robin West is with PFG Energy. He says the price of gas will remain a factor.
First thing, the price of gas has come down, but it's still pretty high. What our analysis shows is that when gasoline is above $3.50 a gallon, it starts affecting people's behavior.
West says there's a lag time before people's habits catch up with the reality of the pump.
Driving patterns change, and one of the key indicators to watch when gasoline prices start going up, people's disposable income changes. One of the areas, for example, is the restaurant business gets hit very quickly because that's a clearly disposable item.
Also, drivers are still flocking towards fuel-efficient cars. Meanwhile, Phil Flynn says normally, we'd see gas prices go up for summertime, but this year, things are different.
The U.S. production of oil is at the highest level it's been, probably since the 1960s, and that's going to give us lower gasoline prices, hopefully, in the future.
And remember the politicians we heard at the beginning of the story? Flynn says both parties usually get quiet about gas come fall, even with an election looming. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
U.S. patent number D486486 reads, quote, a display device with a movable assembly attached to a flat panel display and to a base, end quote. Then there's patent number D469109 for, quote, the ornamental design for a media player, substantially as shown and described. Those are just a couple of the hundreds of patents that bear the name Steven P. Jobs, the late CEO of Apple. A new exhibition opened on Friday at the Smithsonian's Ripley Center here in Washington, D.C., and it's titled The Patents and Trademarks of Steve Jobs, Art and Technology That Changed the World. Walter Isaacson is the author of Steve Jobs' biography. He joins us now in our studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me, Rachel.
So when we think of the pantheon of great American inventors, Edison and Ford, the Wright brothers come to mind. Based on the work that you did and your relationship with Steve Jobs, does he belong in that company?
Oh, absolutely. And he had the greatest design collaboration of our day and era, which is he and Johnny Ive, who is the great industrial designer at Apple. And you mentioned the display device with movable arms or whatever. That's the famous sort of sunflower-looking iMac that they did, I think, you know, in the early 2000s. And it came about when a flat screen was developed. And Johnny had created something in which the screen was attached to the computer, and it didn't feel like it had real integrity. Then Jobs was kind of annoyed, and he went home. And his wife, who plants this beautiful garden behind the house in Palo Alto, had planted sunflowers, a profusion of them. And when Johnny came over, they were sitting there and walking around, and they just looked at the sunflowers and how there's a certain essence of the sunflower and how it floats above the plant. And that became that iMac. And, of course, Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive have their names on the design patent.
Is the credit that Steve Jobs is given for these patents deserved insofar as his ability to kind of identify something like that sunflower? Yeah. I mean, is that as valuable as being able to put it into making something out of it?
Well, one of the things Steve was able to do is conceive great designs, but also execute them. He had an intuitive feel for things. Like at one point, Johnny Ive showed him a recessed handle that was on that beautiful iMac of, I think, the late 1990s. It felt like it had just hopped on your desk. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the rabbit-looking iMac. It had a handle, and the handle wasn't truly necessary. This was a desktop machine, but Johnny Ive explained it makes it friendly. People are afraid to touch computers, but having a recessed handle makes it just say to you, you can touch me, I'm at your service. And that's what Steve Jobs understood.
And it was every step of product development, packaging even.
You know, he was taught in the early 1980s by a great guy named Mike Markala that the packaging really matters. You have to impute a beauty to a product from the moment people see the box. And so he has a design patent with some other people at Apple. I think Steve's name may be first on it, of just the way you open the box to the original iPod and how it is cradled. And you open it and it hinges like a jewel. There's a certain theater, an emotional theater in the unpacking.
Makes me feel like I should wrap my Christmas presents better.
You should.
If you had to pick one, what was one of the fiercest fights that Steve Jobs and Apple had to fight when it came to patents?
Well, obviously the fiercest fight was the fight against Microsoft in the 1980s. And there's a good example of a design look and feel originally developed at Xerox PARC, which is a graphical user interface. And you're looking at a computer screen now, and it probably has icons like trash cans and folders and documents
Indeed
and everything else.
Indeed it does.
Some of those elements were invented at Xerox PARC. Steve made a deal with Xerox that the Apple team could come in, see it, and try to adopt it. And what Steve did was he improved it. You could drag the documents and dump them into folders. You could double-click on the folders, and they would pop open. You could pull down menus. All of these were improvements to the design Apple did. So then Microsoft comes along and pretty much copies a lot of the look and feel of that graphical user interface for Windows. And that was one of the great intellectual property fights of our time, because Steve Jobs felt pretty strongly that Microsoft had ripped off the look and feel of the Macintosh operating system.
You had extraordinary access to him. Did you come away thinking that it was more important for him to be remembered as an artist rather than an incredibly successful revolutionary CEO?
Absolutely. Look, when they do the original Macintosh in 1983, he holds it up for a while because the circuit board isn't beautiful enough for his taste. Now, that's not the way to maximize profits, but it is the way to say, I'm an artist, and even the parts unseen should be beautiful.
Walter Isaacson is the author of Steve Jobs' biography. The patents and trademarks of Steve Jobs' exhibition is on display at the Smithsonian's Ripley Center here in Washington, D.C. until July 8th. Walter Isaacson, thanks so much for coming in.
It was great being with you, Rachel.
You are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Okay, let's bring in James Fallows of The Atlantic now. He is with us most Saturdays for a look behind the headlines. Jim, great to have you.
Thank you, Guy.
A lot of ink has been spilled over the significance, of course, of President Obama's remarks in support of gay marriage this week. I know you've been thinking a lot about this in a historical context, so take us back to some comparable moments.
So there's none that is exactly parallel, but it's interesting to see the pattern. I would start in 1939, when the Daughters of the American Revolution had denied permission to the great black American opera singer Marian Anderson to sing at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. And in response to that, Eleanor Roosevelt and her husband, the incumbent President Franklin Roosevelt, arranged for her to sing to a national audience on the Lincoln Memorial on Easter Sunday, which had huge symbolic effect. In 1947 and 1948, President Harry Truman prepared the ground for and then ordered the integration of the armed forces at a time when this was still quite controversial, and indeed probably there was more resistance to it than support at the time.
There is much that state and local governments can do in providing positive safeguards for civil rights, but we cannot any longer await the growth of a will to action in the slowest state or the most backward community. Our national government must show the way.
In 1957, Dwight Eisenhower, who personally had been opposed to or skeptical of the Supreme Court ruling ordering school integration, nonetheless directed that federal troops go into Little Rock, Arkansas to enforce the integration of Little Rock Central High School, which Governor Faubus of Arkansas and local forces were resisting.
Whenever normal agencies prove inadequate to the task, and it becomes necessary for the executive branch of the federal government to use its powers and authority to uphold federal courts, the president's responsibility is inescapable.
Then last on this list would be in 1965, after the protests and riots and showdowns and bloodshed in Selma, Alabama, President Lyndon Johnson appeared before the Congress to give what's known as his "We Shall Overcome" speech, saying that this moment had to be the impetus for new civil rights legislation.
Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice, and we shall overcome.
Jim, all of these examples, of course, involved race and not sexuality, and in most cases involved actions that presidents took, things that they decided to do in response. Are they fair comparisons to what President Obama said this past week?
They're not perfect comparisons because, as you say, the racial struggle of America is more intrinsic to our entire national drama than other struggles for equality. And also, President Obama very markedly did not order any change in policy this past week with his comments. But I think they're similar in a president deciding that there is a change underway in public opinion, and he's going to side in favor of a group that at that moment he views as being unfavored and even mistreated.
Jim, in the past, presidents have also expressed regret for not speaking out, for not saying what they felt they should have said at the time.
For example, Dwight Eisenhower, for my money, one of the greatest Americans, has said that among the few things he regretted in his public life was not taking a step like the one President Obama has just taken. In the early 1950s, President Eisenhower did not publicly criticize or fight back against Joseph McCarthy in the original version of red baiting. He worked against him privately, but not in public. Also in 1954, when Emmett Till was lynched in Mississippi, President Eisenhower did not take a stand against that publicly either, and I know that that caused him regret too. So of the regrets Barack Obama may later have, I think this moment will not be among them.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Guy.